word why, what a curious word. The kind of word that can make us cringe, feel defensive, or even distant. But you know, sometimes why is the key. The key that can unlock so much to our lives. Join me as we explore the why with fascinating contributors to the world. Those that entertain us, inform us, teach us about life, and if we're lucky, inspire the next in all of us. I'm your host, Dr. Rod Berger. And welcome to Headroom, a production of Rainlight and co-produced by Old Soul. Let's go.
Okay, audience, you're going to have to trust me. We're going to go down a rabbit hole in AI, but we're going to do so with an expert, I think a trailblazer, and someone who's incredibly thoughtful about the space and is asking questions about how to impact the world around us, our day-to-day operations, and to do so from a position of, I think, prominence and one that can be looked up to, not only by girls and females in technology, but just by those in deep tech entrepreneurship. We're going to be speaking today with Sarah Nagy. She's the co-founder and CEO of Seek AI, a firm in the generative AI space that uses natural language query for structured data sets. A self-described quant, in her words, quant. Sarah founded Seek AI in 2021. She most recently led the consumer data team on Wall Street at Citadel Ashler Capital. Prior to joining Citadel, Sarah led enterprise data product development at two startups, Edison and Predata, which both exited. She started her career as a quant at ITG, developing algorithmic trading strategies. Sarah has a master in finance degree from Princeton and a dual bachelor's degrees from UCLA in astrophysics and business economics. In 2023, she was listed as one of the Business Insider's AI 100. Wow, I'm getting tongue-tied already. That's not a good sign here, Sarah. You know what's interesting? I was just saying to you off air that I'm getting a lot of pitches, which I don't think is a surprise. All these pitches have to do with AI. And it's every, you know, from content, marketing to data. I mean, it's just sort of everywhere. And sometimes I find it difficult to parse through sort of where's the meaning, sort of, you know, how do we get past the white noise of it and have conversations where we understand not only the benefit, the potential impact, but also the truth in that we also don't know what it can bring, right? It's we are that new in the space, or at least from my perspective. Why AI for you? Was this a natural extension? I mean, obviously with your background in education, I get the sense that you sort of could pick maybe what you wanted to do or the path that you wanted to take. And yet you decided to become a first-time CEO fresh out of the pandemic. And I'm just wondering what was the impetus for you to do that?
Yeah, I mean, Seek was founded about a year, a little over a year, actually, prior to ChatGPT. So, you know, when you mention all this kind of noise that we're seeing right now around AI and kind of, you know, how do you parse out the signal from the noise? That's pretty easy for me to do because having started Seek in a pre-ChatGPT world that was utilizing generative AI even as early as 2021, you know, I can always reflect on the pre-ChatGPT times and kind of remember, you know, why I started Seek before all the hype even began. And so to tell you a little bit about why I started Seek, so like you just mentioned, I worked with large data sets for a very long time. And, you know, throughout all these different, you know, jobs that you described, I just kind of kept noticing the same problem happen over and over again everywhere I worked. And that problem was I wanted to be doing research and solving really meaningful problems for a business. You know, like that was why I got into quantitative finance, because I wanted to be kind of unearthing, you know, new alpha from all this data and, you know, feel proud if the company made a trade and made a lot of money. Not just feel proud, but, you know, hopefully increase my income as well. And, you know, that's just like, really not what my job ended up being. Like that was a little bit of my job, but I would actually say most of my job involved helping non-technical people even just access the data. So what that kind of looked like would be, you know, for example, an investor might come up to me and be like, hey, Sarah, I want to make this trade. Can you, pull this certain data? You know, I actually used to cover healthcare at Citadel. I did end up, moving on to consumer, but healthcare was the first sector I covered. So, you know, it could have been like, hey, can you like do this research on, Da Vinci machines and this data, can you pull like this trend? And I would basically have to go into the data set, write a bunch of very manual, very mundane code. I would say my least favorite language was SQL because, there was just nothing like exciting about it to me. So I just really really did not enjoy having to just write this SQL code, like word by word to pull this basic data, but I just had no other choice. Like there were tools that we would try to give the non-technical people, but even the tools were too complicated. So basically what happened was the only way they could access the data was to ask me questions. And so when I kind of discovered, large language models that could generate code in 2020, in particular, I'm talking about GPT-3, which I had been, I had known about large language models since probably 2018, or really 2019. But the thing that was interesting in 2020 with GPT-3 was it could actually write pretty high quality SQL code. And so when I saw that, I was like, the thing about these models is you can ask them questions, and that's something that non-technical people are really good at. And if I
can we can ask questions.
Yeah. Like I know that they can ask me questions.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm like, but I'm writing all this code that is just so boring that I'm like, an AI probably could do this. So when I discovered an AI that kind of had both these pieces, that's when I was like, this might be the thing that finally solves the problem. So that
so
was
in some, so in some way we forced you to start your own company so that you could free yourself up to do the things that you love doing in summation.
Yeah. So like maybe once Seek, exits, I might actually have what I need to go back to doing the job I wanted to do. No, I'm just kidding. But
yeah, I think you've permanently changed tracks here for all of our benefit. Okay. Help me understand this, Sarah. I keep hearing people, again, I'm going to say sort of common or lay people that, and I would be in that group. I'll hear this sort of thought pattern around AI and comparing it to other technological advancements and saying, well, this is just a fad right now. And maybe it's because I've had the luxury to interview very thoughtful people and noted people in the AI space that my brain, sort of the bells ring like an alarm saying, no, you're wrong. You don't get it. This is not a fad. Like our trajectory as a species and the way in which we engage in life is permanently altered. Am I wrong, or is it just that the general press and sort of people at soccer practice and the grocery store don't understand that this isn't new? We're like in version 4, and maybe that's shortchanging it.
I definitely agree. Maybe just even going back to like pre-ChatGPT times when I was, Seek was not the only path that I considered. I had other career paths that I was also considering as well. And one path was kind of what was really hot at the time, which was starting a crypto hedge fund or, crypto trading. Because I have a finance background and, sure. I traded crypto and all that stuff because, it sounds like right now, like it's a winter and it's crazy to even be talking about it to this audience. But when you're in the finance world, if you're smart, you're going to pay attention to every type of asset that's out there. So anyway, it's like 2021, even 2022, that was the hot thing to do. Like that's what all my friends were doing. That's what all the really well-funded startups seem to be building. So to be an AI founder in 2021 and 2022, I just felt like such a not outcast, but just just like I was not building the cool thing at the time.
See, now I think that would surprise a lot of people, Sarah. I would think that it would have been the opposite, but even in your circle, right? And I mean, I know you're probably very humble about this, but when you think about sort of your intellect and the background that you have, I mean, you're a one percenter, and we're going to benefit from intelligent, I think, explorers. I think of you like an explorer, because you have the guts and the courage to go and try new things that, you know, some of us, we just don't have that capability. You know, we have talents in other areas, but I can't believe that you were an outsider. Okay, so let's take that and then sort of plug into this algorithm that you are a female in deep tech. Are you at a table of one? Is it a lonely table in the corner? Help me understand that. And are we bucking sort of trends and legacies of the past where women have been historically marginalized in technology, let alone in investment?
Yeah, I would say that didn't help in terms of me, like, you know, building the thing at the time that wasn't the cool thing to build. And then also, I talk pretty openly about, being female or non-binary in the tech world, or especially AI world. I think the biggest thing for me was psychologically, there was just certain conditioning growing up that, to be honest, I think, affected how I perceived the world and myself, that was kind of like almost like a weapon that was hurting me in the beginning, kind of like decreasing my abilities. So I just feel like the process of starting a company and needing to develop a thick skin to survive, to even like get customers or raise funding, helped me really erase, I would hope, like most of that very harmful conditioning.
Is deep tech inclusive, Sarah? I mean, I know you mentioned and identified non-binary, and I want to respect that. I want to understand if there's an inclusive environment within deep tech, or are we literally at the sort of the forefront of this, and we don't know how far that horizon line extends, but we need to do a better job to inspire younger generations that deep tech is inclusive and thoughtful, right? And not divisive or exclusionary.
I think that our society could do a better job making STEM or deep tech, whatever it is, you know, making it kind of cool for women. I mean, if you go on TikTok and you look at who are the coolest influencers, they're talking about STEM and deep tech, you know. And if that was something that was like really cool to be doing, I think we live in a completely different world. So I think it's that kind of messaging that is very harmful. Have you seen the thing, like, speaking of gender, there's this viral thing on Twitter, like a week or two ago, that basically was like showing all the words that mostly men, that very few women know, and all the words that very few men know. And it's funny because since I'm like, you know, I identify as non-binary as well, and I knew all the words basically, which is kind of funny. But it's like, if you look at it, like, what are the words that men know that women don't know? It's very, very, very sad. It just was very upsetting. It's words like boson or piezoelectricity. And I'm like, men are not like, I don't know, that it kind of feels like these are all words that like geniuses should know. Like, you know, why are all the genius words in the male side? And on the women's side, it was all like clothing, like taffeta, jacquard, you know? And I was just like, this is like very, very upsetting to me. And I'm like, it says a lot about our society that, you know, like, I don't hear TikTok influencers talking about piezoelectricity, you know, like,
right.
So I'm like, that's part of like the male culture. And I'm like, I just feel like I'm not very happy with how polarized the culture is. And it, you know, this not being cool for women, I think is just like, you know, that's just kind of the thing I see, that I just wish I saw more of it, kind of like being in our culture.
How can we tell more of those stories? What's interesting when you think about AI as a topic, there are lots of people that have lots of answers. And a lot of people are speaking on stages with answers relative to AI. And I take a little bit of a different tack on that. It's that I want to explore the impact on the decisions that are made. And I love that example of sort of language, right? And if we think about technology, it is a language. Many of us don't speak, but there's a portion of the society that does, and hence the innovation, right? And the exploration in the spaces and places we've never been. But I wonder about when we, to your point earlier, you know, you were solving a problem because you were being inundated, right? You're sort of like what I was thinking about. It's like the classic high school counselor who went into it for mental health and to support students, but all they do all day long is work on rosters and schedules and bureaucracy. And they're going, I'd like to get back to why I even came into this profession, right? So that, I think, dilemma many have faced. You had an opportunity to tap into your intellect and ask some really big questions. And it sounds like enough people listened that Seek AI was able to get off the ground. And now you're on your path to thriving. That's a very long-winded way of saying, what do we think the long tail impact is of a world where we don't need a Serenagy to go and write SQL code manually on the young person that is either entering university or deciding if they're going to get a graduate degree? And I'll give you an example. So I work with students at Vanderbilt's business school, almost two decades now, in the financial space. And they will talk about, this was the first year, there was significant fear about their own industry that they're going into being sort of wiped away or decimated by AI. And how do we understand how we can make people feel inclusive, whether that is a non-binary female or anybody that's in essence not identifying as male, to say, hey, look, this is a really cool profession and you have all the skills and talents to do it. How do we do that? Hold that as a truth, and also hold as a truth that some of the professions that we've had for generations will be altered permanently by AI.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty scary, you know, like for some people, like I know, you know, other data people that really, really like writing SQL. You know, it's very rare. It's like 1% of data people that I've met. But there is that kind of personality of like, I really enjoy doing manual work. Like, I love this. I heard someone say, like, I love the smell of SQL in the morning. And I'm just like, can't
really. That's like someone who likes to work on cars as a hobby, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It is in that vein of like, it is something that is very, you know, it's like doing dishes. It's like very, very soothing in a way. So I'm not trying to belittle it, but I'm just kind of saying it's manual work that I think most of us don't really enjoy doing, especially answering these kind of ad hoc questions. And also just even in my day-to-day work as a data professional, like even when I didn't have to answer other people's questions, when I was able to do research, I still just felt like now I'm the one asking all these questions. But, you know, it's like, I just want the answer. Like, I don't want to have to write all this code out by hand and look at the data and do all this exploration. Like, I don't really care about that stuff. Like, I just want to get my answer to my research question so that I can get that information and make progress with my research. So, you know, I think just thinking about things in that way, like, I honestly think AI is going to force a lot of people to need to think about kind of bigger questions. You know, like in my example, as you know, as a data scientist, a lot of that, you know, repetitive work is being automated away.
Gone, right?
And what that means is like, what are you going to be doing with all your time? Like, you're going to have a lot more time to just, you could read papers, you could just go on a walk and think. You could maybe even have like a 4-day work week and spend just a day like at the spa, like just thinking.
But wouldn't you say though, there would be economic implications, right? Because if you're a data scientist and slowly the tasks that you might have had in 2020 are starting to just erode. At some point in time, I would imagine that someone in the talent office or in HR is going to have a really difficult conversation, because you're going to be less valuable monetarily than you once were. And could you not argue that a corporation is going to say, we better invest in this AI because it can do the work, you know, of 10 employees. I mean, I'm just sort of making that up, but exponentially more work for less over time. And if we're in a capitalist society, we've got to think about that at some point in time. And that's the part that I'm wondering. And I'm struggling to see, are we looking from an educational perspective? Are we teaching young people about AI and deep tech? Two things. One, so that they can get a grasp of potentially the world that they're entering, and maybe that impacts the decision making, like from a Plinko example, right? Where is it going to land? But also to understand sort of their own value and what they might enjoy, because I sure would like to know if something was going to be changing in 6 to 9 months in my world, because I might pivot or I might start reading other things to educate myself to see, you know what? Okay, this is different. I didn't expect it, but I'm going to pivot. And I don't know if we're teaching about that in schools, let alone high schools, to give young people a shot.
Headroom is produced by Old Soul, a one-stop marketing agency that understands the power of brand and nuance. Reach out to my guy, Matt, at Old Soul and supercharge your brand and content strategy. That's Old Soul. Shoot Matt a note at aoldsoul.com. That's aoldsoul.com. And now back to our guest.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. You know, it reminds me of when I was in college, it was during the financial crisis of 2007, 2008.
What an exciting time to be at university, right?
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, I remember the same thing happening back then. Like, I had this really great mentor that saw all that was happening, and I was studying business economics, and we saw all that was happening. And, you know, my mentor was just like, Sarah, like, they're not teaching you about this stuff in your classes, and it's very important. So we worked together to try to change the curriculum. In 2008. Yeah. We'd like basically tried to have these conversations with the head of the economics department that we need to change the curriculum right now to teach people what's happening. And so I totally understand that. I totally agree. I think we need to change everything right now so that people know about, you know, AI, people know about, I mean, honestly, it's also, I think it's very important that everyone is exposed to code as well. I think it's very important that everyone has that opportunity to at least consider, opportunities to learn how to code.
It's a learning. I mean, you're learning a language, right? I mean, I could choose French or German or Spanish, or what if it was required to understand the tenets of code? I mean, where I am from my age, Sarah, is that I remember you could learn DOS. Okay, that's way back. And it was a select few kids would do that. I mean, there was nobody that sort of smiled and said, sign me up in high school. That was just not happening. So you have an entire generation from like mine backwards that have, unless it was a natural sort of element of the way in which their mind worked and they sort of had resources and opportunities come their way, you have generations that will not be able to speak the language of not just the future, but the present. And that to me is really concerning, that we're not talking about it. Or if we do, we're just labeled as an alarmist. It's like, I interviewed Hadi Partovi. He's the founder of code.org, a really thoughtful, smart guy. And he was saying to me, he said, you know, most people think this is like, we're moving at breakneck speed. He said, this point right now is the slowest point of innovation. We're going to look back. And it, right? And you sort of, it feels a little bit mind bending. And you say, okay, if that's the case, you know, we're so used to sort of as generations age, you go, well, how do we keep them engaged, or how do we sort of tap into the knowledge and skills that they have? Well, I feel like that age marker is going to continue to drop younger and younger, and you're going to get people in their 40s and 50s that don't feel connected because they don't feel like they know how to even speak the language, let alone contribute. Do you see that from your seat?
Yeah, I do see a lot of fragmentation when it comes to the type of information that everybody has access to. I mean, yeah, like you talked about, definitely people who have been in the workforce for 20, 30 years, you know, need to know about even just opportunities about how they can learn to code. And it's like just saying that, like, I don't know if you follow those people on Twitter that, like, you know, would tweet at those journalists and be like, learn to code. I feel like one of those people right now, but you know, like, I feel like those people gave this a very bad rap. But it's kind of true. Like, everyone should at least know about the importance of, you know, either just knowing what writing code is, like what that career path looks like. If, you know, if they're thinking about a pivot, they should definitely, you know, everyone should know about the resources that are out there. Like, I'm glad you spoke with this person from code.org. And there's just so many, you know, this is like pre ChatGPT times. Like, I think at one point there was a lot of talk about these, you know, so-called MOOCs, right? M-O-O-C-S.
Oh yes, the MOOC. Yeah. They were going to change the world, weren't they?
Yeah. And I was really into them. Like, yeah. I did so many. Like, I literally have a degree from Udacity in, you know, like robotics. So, like, but it's just, you know, like, I remember when I was really into them, like, I would tell people about it and they'd be like, I don't know what that is, you know, like, I've never heard of Udacity before. So it just kind of goes back to this fragmentation. You know, like with Seek, I wish there was more that we could do about it. You know, maybe I will become more involved with this kind of thing, because I love to see initiatives to make sure that everyone knows about education opportunities. Like, for $20 a month, you can go on Code Academy and learn to become a full stack engineer in like 2 months. I mean, like, you're not going to be like senior level. I'm just saying that's actually part of how I built Seek. Like, I didn't know how to do web development when I started, but I just did Code Academy, and that's how I was able to build the prototype as a single founder in my apartment.
See, that's an incredible, so that ties into story. And my hope and selfish desire is that those in deep tech celebrate story in a way that says we have to bring people along. Right. In essence, you can innovate all day long, but if you become such a niche part of society, it could get lonely on both sides of that, I think. And we lose out on talent and ways in which to support sort of the evolution, hopefully the healthy evolution of our species. But is that we would tell stories. And classically, that's not been something that those in technology have been either interested in or known for, which is, what's the narrative? Like, while you're developing, while you're iterating and innovating, what's the narrative? Because maybe that's a way to get people involved and engaged. I mean, the irony is, we all know there's, you know, the software adoption curve, right? If you're going to sort of lay out new technology to consumers, how do you sort of stair step them into it so that they feel connected? I mean, when the iPad first came out, I mean, my goodness, I mean, how many people didn't even know how to turn it on? I mean, it was like they would, I mean, I remember trainings in technology that I would witness, and people struggled with where the power button was. And you're going, it is 2010, like 11. Like, what are we talking about here? But the story piece of it, I think, is important. Where, as we pivot, Sarah, tell me a little bit about your family and the ingredients that you think retrospectively were necessary to put you in a position of opportunity and sort of self-selection of what you wanted to do and what you're doing now based on when you were young growing up.
Yeah. So I grew up in the Bay Area. Silicon Valley. So I was around a lot of other kids. Like I went to public school, so I was in that world for elementary school and, the first part of middle school. And that was definitely a great place to grow up. It was just probably the best place to grow up. It was just, I was just surrounded by just really cool tech. Like I loved the San Jose Tech Museum. That was like my favorite place. And I was definitely surrounded by a lot of really smart kids that had parents that were very strict on them. And I didn't actually have strict parents. My parents were very nice. Like they actually wanted me to become an artist.
They did.
Yeah, because I loved drawing. I loved art when I was a kid. And so my parents really wanted me to just become an artist. But I actually didn't want to become an artist, I have a very competitive spirit, I would say. And so being surrounded by all these other kids whose parents were being very hard on them and they were just working so hard, I saw them all like working so hard. And I was like, that makes me want to work hard too. So I kind of just, ended up, being inspired by all these other kids, all my peers in school, and becoming, very ambitious, more so, later on in high school, I would say really is when that side really came out. But I just kind of remember that. So overall, it was a really positive environment to be raised in. I didn't have strict parents that were pushing me. It ended up being, in general, like in life, I think people put too much emphasis on their parents and not enough emphasis on the kids around them when they were growing up. Because my friends had equally or more influence on me growing up than my parents, I would actually say.
That's a great, great point. That actually came up yesterday with one of my kids and some other kids that go to a different school. And they were talking about sort of grades, and it was actually cool to not get good grades. Yet my son's in an environment where it sounds more like you and your experience where no, they're pushed and it's celebrated to work hard and to achieve. And so I could see his face as if, are they speaking a different language? It's such a fantastic point that you make that environment that we surround them in has such an impact. What advice do you have, Sarah, as we sort of round out our discussion? What advice do you have for entrepreneurs? And I'll let you pick whether it's male, female, or it doesn't even matter, sort of designation here, for an entrepreneur that is, let's just say, of college age, or they're starting to think about it. I mean, how many high school kids out there have now started businesses? But advice that you have, and real advice too, because I think that's one challenge we have. Everybody now is going to be an entrepreneur. And I wonder if people have sort of the mental makeup to go through all the challenges, because very rarely is it easy at any point in the stage, but you learn a lot about yourself. And I'd be curious as to advice you'd give young entrepreneurs.
So again, I think it's helpful to think about, pre-ChatGPT times, COVID times. I just remember, maybe around 2018 or 2019, I started to notice that Gen Z tends to be a lot more entrepreneurial, or so I read, than millennials or Gen X or any other generations. Doing things like starting side hustles while they're working full time, even having more than one side hustle. And I feel like it's kind of the Gen Z, not to generalize across an entire generation, but I do feel like it's kind of a Gen Z dream to be a business owner. I don't think there's anything unusual about it anymore from what I've read. What I've seen personally is a little less extreme than how the media portrays Gen Z, but I do see it myself as well. I guess what I would say is I really like that there's this entrepreneurial spirit. I think AI is definitely going to empower, you know, more people to become entrepreneurs, because it's just going to lower the barrier to entry to so many things that used to be hard when it comes to starting a business. So that was kind of the direction I saw our society going before ChatGPT, even, you know, before COVID. And I think we don't talk about it as much anymore now that all we talk about is AI, but I just think we need to remember that, because, you know, for someone just starting out, I would say definitely consider entrepreneurship and just think about how AI could be helpful, not worry about a certain career path that, you know, there are certain careers that, I don't know a lot about legal AI, for example, but I kind of feel like from what I'm seeing, like paralegal, you know, the careers of paralegals may change a lot. And if you used to want to do something like that, instead of kind of holding on to wanting to do that, if you kind of have a feeling it's going to, you know, a lot of that job would get automated, I think it's probably a lot, it would produce a better state of mind, I would think, to consider, you know, how could I use this technology? What do I love about this career path that might be changing? And how could I, you know, perhaps take what I love, but maybe modernize it through entrepreneurship or finding, there's also lots of new career paths that I think will pop up in this space, or just in general. So maybe just also considering new, you know, career paths that may have not existed. It is, you know, I just will say I definitely empathize with just a lot of the worry about certain things that might get automated, especially if these, you know, were things that, you know, maybe someone would have wanted to do in the past. So, you know, I think there's definitely pros and cons to just tech innovation in general, but just accepting that that's reality, you know, this would be my best advice. And I think that there are going to be so many positives that come from this.
That outweigh it. Yeah, it's about, to borrow vernacular from your world, it's about the query, right? It's about the question. And if we can ask really good questions, we might actually reveal an opportunity we didn't see there previously. Well, Sarah, what a pleasure to spend time with you. I want to make sure that people can check out Seek AI. You can just go to seek.ai. We want to thank Sarah Nagy. She's the co-founder and CEO of Seek AI. Like I said before, last year, she was listed as one of Business Insider's AI 100. What a pleasure. I think you are a trailblazer in the space. I stand by that. And I think it's important for young people to pay attention to those that are carving out paths that are new, and I think beneficial to all sorts of businesses and sectors, not just here in the US, but across the globe. Continued success to you.
Thanks for taking the plunge into Headroom, where we uncover the why behind the what and who impacting our lives. Headroom is a production of Rainlight and co-produced by our friends at Old Soul. I'm your host, Dr. Rod Berger, and this is Headroom.